Jewish audio on Kabad.org.
Rabbi Beryl Bell resides in Montreal, Canada. He is a member of the Rabbinical Court of Montreal, author and director of teacher training for the Jewish Learning Institute, and lectures extensively on Jewish topics.
Contained in Parshas Beshalach is one of the most famous events in all of Jewish history, the splitting of the sea upon the exodus of the Jewish people from Egypt. At the beginning of the parsha, it is described how the Jews left the land of Egypt and how the Egyptians decided to try to chase them. And eventually they caught up to them after they had passed Pi Achires, the Torah tells us. And at that point, the Jews noticed the Egyptians were chasing them and they became extremely frightened. In their fear, they began to scream at Moshe and complain to him. And actually, the Mechilta tells us that the Jewish people divided themselves into four groups, that there were four different strategies or responses that they had in how to respond to this, that Pharaoh and the Egyptians were chasing them. And the Mechilta describes the four groups. The first one decided that they would throw themselves into the sea, that rather than risk being caught by the Egyptians and brought back to be enslaved in Egypt, they would rather kill themselves by throwing themselves into the ocean. A second group decided that they would prefer to give themselves up, to surrender, and return to the land of Egypt, that it would be better to live and be enslaved there than to die in the desert. A third group decided that they would turn themselves back and face the Egyptians and make war with them. As our sages say, that they actually took weapons with them when they left Egypt, therefore they were prepared for war and wanted to fight against the Egyptians. And then there was a fourth group, and the fourth group didn't want to do any of these things. It merely said, we should pray for help from God. Let us scream out to him so that he will save us. And Moses answers them all in one statement, beginning with verse 13 in chapter 14. He tells them, do not be afraid. Hisyatzvu uru es Yeshuas Hashem. Stand firm and see that Hashem will rescue you. And this was the answer to the first group that wanted to throw themselves into the ocean. Moses said, don't throw yourselves in and kill yourselves, because Hashem will save you. Stand firm. To the second group that wanted to return to Egypt, Moses answered that you will never again return to see the Egyptians. Leisisifuli resam eid ad elam. To the third group that wanted to make war against the Egyptians, Moses said, Hashem yilochem lochem. Hashem will make war for you, that you should not take weapons against the Egyptians. And to the fourth group that wanted to pray for godly intervention, Moses answered, V'atem tachrishun, that you should be silent. This is no time for prayer. You should rather not pray. What then were they to do? The next verse says that God spoke to Moses and said, Dabre el bnei Yisrael v'yiso, speak to the children of Israel and let them get moving, let them travel. There are a number of puzzling aspects about this mechilta. First of all, what was the matter with the response of the last two groups, and particularly the final one? This, that they were in trouble and they wanted to scream out to Hashem, this seems to be an appropriate reaction. What then is a person supposed to do when he is in trouble? He should scream for godly intervention, and this is exactly what they did. But they were not doing the correct thing, the Torah tells us. They were told by Moshe, V'atem tachrishun, you should be silent. And even the third group that wanted to make war, what would be the matter with that? They came out of Egypt, and they saw that God intervened to save them from the Egyptians, so they should really use their best abilities to try to fight the Egyptians. What was the matter with such a response? And in particular, why should we lump all four of them together? That there were four groups, the Mechilta says, and we see Moses answered all four together. Certainly there's a tremendous difference between the first group who wanted to really commit suicide and as a result of their feeling of hopelessness, and even those that wanted to return to Egypt, how can they be compared with the last two groups that wanted to fight the Egyptians or that wanted to scream out to Hashem for godly help? Everything which is conveyed to us in the Torah is of internal importance and application. And this applies particularly to the story of the Exodus from Egypt, as we have an explicit commandment from our sages that one should look upon oneself every single day as if he has personally come out of the Egyptian bondage. Therefore, everything regarding the Exodus is certainly of eternal application. and particularly has explained in Hasidic philosophy what is the idea, actually how can we look upon ourselves each day coming out of Egypt. Most of us were never ever in Egypt in the first place. As the Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya, that it refers to the Jew's exodus from the spiritual Egypt, the spiritual Mitzrayim. That the Hebrew word for Egypt, Mitzrayim, comes from the root word Metzorim Ugvulim, limits and boundaries. In particular, a Jew has a difficulty in expressing his godly potential and the desires of his godly soul because of his animal soul, the desires within him which are not in consonance with those of Torah and mitzvahs. And these limit him in his desire to come closer to Hashem. He encounters obstacles and difficulties, and these are his particular mitzorim, his limitations, his mitzrayim. And therefore he must go out of this Mitzrayim, out of this Egypt, every single day through breaking through his animal soul and the limitations around him. And so too, as we have this as the worst type of limitation of an actual Yetzer Hara or evil inclination, so too there are more sophisticated types of limitations. A person might be serving God in Torah and mitzvahs, and even in his service in Torah and mitzvahs, he could be doing so in a limited way. He could be in a sort of Egypt within holiness, that wherever he is, he could still be in a sort of Mitzrayim, a sort of Egypt. And the Torah tells us that we must go out of that Egypt as well, that every day and at every level and stage of progression, we must go out of our own personal Egypt, our personal limitations. And so too, in our investigation of this Mechilta, we can learn something about how to go out of our personal Egypt. In particular, we see that the Jewish people at this time, when this story is taking place, were already out of the physical Egypt. They had even passed Pi Achides, which is the place where slaves were normally freed, according to some commentaries, and therefore they were really out of Egypt. Just because the Egyptians decided to pursue them, the exodus from Egypt was not complete until they finally passed the Yam Suf and went through the sea. This being the case, we see that the Jewish people were in a sort of intermediate state. On the one hand, they were out of Mitzrayim, they had already left Egypt, but on the other hand, their escape had not been complete because they had not yet gone through the sea and the Egyptians were still chasing them. How does this state apply on a spiritual level? If a person still has desires and impulses which are contrary to those of the Torah, we see that he still has not left Egypt, even in the simple sense. In order to leave Egypt, meaning his personal limitations, he must first conquer those desires which are contrary to the Torah. Should he not have done that, he is still in Egypt. In this part of the story, the Jews are already out of Egypt, they're just not completely out of Egypt. And therefore, this would correspond to a person that no longer has desires which are contrary to Torah and mitzvahs, but is rather in a state of Mitzrayim, of limitations within his service of God in Torah and mitzvahs itself. And in this, we have four different categories corresponding to four problematic attitudes. When a person observes Torah and mitzvahs and looks at the world around him, he is puzzled. How can he accomplish anything with his Torah and mitzvahs? After all, the world is a hostile environment. It is not in the least receptive to Torah and mitzvahs. How can he hope to have any effect on this darkness which surrounds him? True, he realizes it is his responsibility to spread Torah and mitzvahs throughout the world and to help out his fellow Jews, who might be less knowledgeable than himself. But he looks at the situation and decides that it's utterly hopeless. How could he accomplish anything? The only thing he can possibly do is to save himself, throw himself deeper into Torah and deeper into his prayer and so on, in his holy service of God. This type of person is compared to the first category by the sea. What did they decide to do? They would throw themselves into the sea, which this represents the person throwing himself into the oceans of Torah and the oceans of prayer and of holiness. And although this would seem to be a positive thing, nevertheless the person is isolating himself from the world. He is cutting himself off, as the phrase is used, a tzaddik in pelts, a tzaddik in a fur coat, that a righteous person can keep himself warm if he wears a fur coat, but all the people around him remain cold. He has decided it's hopeless, it's a cold world, and he is so small. How can he warm up the entire world? Better to wrap yourself up in a fur coat, and at least you yourself will keep warm. This seems to be a reasonable attitude. But the problem is, no one is asking this tzaddik to warm up the entire world. Certainly he does not have the ability to warm up the entire world in the middle of the winter. But that doesn't mean he can't take one other Jew and warm him up. Or maybe even two Jews. Or maybe a small corner of the world. Maybe one building. Why wrap yourself up in a coat and ignore everyone else and throw yourselves into the waters of Torah? You must certainly be attached to the waters of Torah, but you must share it and utilize it to bring other people also close to this ocean. There is a second category which is superior to this first one. However, it is also associated with a feeling of hopelessness. However, this second category is not totally overcome with hopelessness, because this second person has a degree of Kabbalah's ale. He has a certain acceptance of the fact that although he might think it's hopeless, he nevertheless has a responsibility to share what he has with others, that he was put down here in the world in order to make the world a better place. And although he feels he can really accomplish nothing, what can he do? He is commanded to do Torah and mitzvahs, and he must do it. So when a person comes to ask him for a favor, he'll do the favor. And even should he hear that there is another Jew somewhere that he can help, he thinks, well, he has a mitzvah of Avos Yisrael. He must love his fellow Jew and he must do him the favor. Oh, so what can he do? He must go and do this favor as well. He feels that he will not really accomplish anything. The world is such a dark place. But unfortunately, he has this mitzvah, and it was made known to him that somebody needs his help. So he happens to be stuck with the job of going and doing this person a favor, or of doing a particular mitzvah, or of doing all the mitzvahs. All of it he looks at as being a tremendously difficult task. He does all of it, and nothing is missing. The only thing is missing is a feeling of liveliness, a feeling of desire, and a feeling of joy. The actions he does, but he does them in a dry way without any feeling. This sort of person corresponds to the second category, the people that said, "Let us go back to Egypt. We will remain slaves in Egypt." That this person feels that he is a slave to the world. The world is really the conquering force, and Torah and mitzvahs do not have the ability to shine through and transform the world to make it a better place. Therefore he says, okay, I'll be a slave to the world. I will still do my job, I will do Torah and mitzvahs, but his inner feeling is one of hopelessness, and one of surrender. What's the problem with this attitude? After all, a Jew is supposed to have his whole service of God founded on the idea of Kabbalah's ale. He must do mitzvahs even if he has no feeling. He must do it as a slave does something for a master. Why then is this person doing something wrong? After all, it seems to be what the Torah requires from us. The answer to that is true, the Torah demands that our service of God be founded, be based on a feeling of Kabbalah's ale, even if we have no feeling. However, that is only the foundation. We must not stop there. A person must go further until his entire service of God is permeated with simcha, with joy, and with liveliness. That when he learns Torah, he must realize that with every word he is learning, he is connecting himself to God. As our sages say, that when a person studies, the Holy One, blessed be He, comes down and learns with him. That he sits opposite the table, so to speak, and joins himself to this learning of Torah. And therefore, when we see someone learning Torah, it should be obvious, it should be recognizable on him, that this is something that which he is experiencing joy, and doing in a lively way. And so too in performing a mitzvah. When a person puts on tefillin, for example, he should have the feeling that not just is he performing a requirement, something he has been commanded to do, that when he takes these tefillin and puts them on, he is infusing this which was previously part of an animal. He is making it a piece of godliness. He is transforming its very essence. And instead of remaining an animal which was not connected with God in any obvious revealed fashion, now he is making it a total expression of God's will. And this gives him a feeling that he has conquered another piece of the world, that it is not a hopeless darkness, that here he has taken part of the world and transformed it to light. And this will cause him to have more of a feeling of joy, and will lead him to approach his mitzvahs in a way of liveliness and enthusiasm. The third group was that which wanted to turn against the Egyptians and make war with them. This group certainly was not suffering from any feeling of hopelessness. They were confident they could go against the Egyptians and make war with them and conquer them. And this would correspond to the sort of person that is not affected by the darkness of the world surrounding him. He is ready to make war with the world and to cut away any of the darkness which is opposing Torah and mitzvahs. What's the problem with such an attitude? It seems to be very, very good. However, the problem with this is that everything has a proper time. There's a time to make war with Egypt, and there's a time where there are more important things which need to be accomplished. The Jews were aware that the exodus from Egypt was a preparation for the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, a Torah which would transform the entire world forever, and was the beginning of the bringing of the world to its complete, perfect state. This being the case, the only thing at that time which should have mattered to them was getting closer to Mount Sinai. Turning around and making war with the Egyptians had several negative consequences. First of all, it's a waste of time. Instead of coming closer to Mount Sinai, you're wasting steps. You could be coming one step further and another mile further, and instead you're wasting time fighting Egyptians. Secondly, the problem with a war is that even when you win a war, there are usually casualties. If there's a way of avoiding a war, you should do that. And a third thing is that how are you sure that your decision to make war is the correct one? One thing you were positive of, you were given a command to go to Mount Sinai. You decide in the middle to stop and turn around and make war. Who says that this is the correct thing to do? It could be this is something which is based on your own personal calculations. And who knows, maybe it really stems from your evil inclination, or your laziness, or your personal preference to do one sort of aveda rather than another. And this, in fact, was the answer which God gave to Moses, V'so, this is no time to fight a war. This is a time to get going. Hashem yilachem lochem. Hashem will fight the war. But your task at this point is to come closer to Mount Sinai. And so, too, for every individual, even should he have various things to do, all within the realm of holiness, he must keep in mind that he must perform his particular mission. If he has a particular task to accomplish, he must stick to that. And even should he digress and do other things which are in the realm of holiness, this perhaps is also not right. He must clarify what is his particular task, and he must stick to it. The fourth group is higher than any of the other three. The first one certainly is a feeling of complete hopelessness. They wanted to throw themselves into the sea. The second one was also a feeling of hopelessness, but nevertheless they did do some sort of service. The third group has no hopelessness whatsoever, but it just misdirected. The fourth category was the idea of screaming out to Hashem for assistance, where this seems to be a perfectly good service. What could be wrong over here? The person is not relying on his own opinion and his own personal inclination. He's giving everything up to Hashem, that he is just stopping what he is doing, and he is completely nullifying his own desires and screaming to Hashem for assistance. He is in a state of complete bittul, complete nullification. What could possibly be wrong with such an attitude? The answer is that a Jew was created in order to serve Hashem in this world, and he must use the particular abilities which he has been given to serve God. It is not enough to abandon his own intellect and his own feelings and give himself up to God and say, I will do whatever you want. He must utilize the intellect he has been given and his own neshama, his soul, in order to serve God. And so too, when they came out of Egypt, this was no time to stop and pray to Hashem. As Hashem said, why are you screaming to me? This is no time to pray. Be so, this is the time to get moving. You have been given a command. You have been told that you must come closer to Mount Sinai. It is the time to accomplish this task. It is not a time for prayer. And although it seems that this person is on an extremely high level, he has completely nullified his own will, that Nevertheless, this is not called self-nullification. Giving up your own abilities that you've already been told to utilize and leaving everything up to Hashem and you keep your own hands folded, that is not the ultimate in self-nullification. That although he is giving up everything he thinks and says, Hashem, I will do whatever you want, this is not the ultimate, because Hashem has already told him what he wants. Now that self-nullification is not expressed in terms of asking Hashem, it is expressed by doing what Hashem has already told you to do. And although we still have to worry that we should not be included in the third group, that the third group had the problem, they decided that they wanted to do something, and they decided the wrong thing. They decided to make war against the Egyptians, and this was not the time for that. So perhaps the fourth group would be concerned about the same thing. If we decide we're going to do something, maybe it's going to be the wrong thing. Maybe it'll be based not on Hashem's desires, rather it'll be because of our own personal inclinations. Better not to do anything, cry out to Hashem, and let him tell us directly what to do. How can we be sure we're doing the correct thing? For this, Hashem answered, V'yiso. He spoke to Moshe and told Moshe to give over to the Jewish people that now is the time to travel, that you have already been told this is the time to come close to Mount Sinai. And if you are unsure of what to do, look to Moshe Rabbeinu, look to Moses. Moses was the only one that told them that all of your four approaches are wrong. This is no time to throw yourself into the ocean, even that of the Torah. It's no time to go back to Egypt in a state of hopelessness, fulfilling things without any feeling and without any joy. It's not even time to be diverted from your true service and make war against the darkness of Egypt. And it's not even time to stop and cry out to Hashem. Now is the time to get moving and go towards the receiving of the Torah. And it is through this, through connecting oneself with Moshe and making sure that one is fulfilling his commands, and so too applying, as our sages say, Ispashtusa de Moshe b'chol dora v'dora, the embodiment of Moses in every single generation, then one can be certain that his service is not based on his own private inclinations and his private preferences. Rather, he is fulfilling his mission in the world of how to serve Hashem properly through spreading Torah and mitzvahs throughout the entire world. And the reward for this service was the splitting of the sea. And as explains the Chassidus, this corresponded to the actual service that they did with themselves. That a Jew has a holy neshama hidden within him, and his job is to reveal it and utilize its full potential. And as the Jews did that before the splitting of the sea, they were rewarded with a similar response, that the sea covers over its floor, and as a result of the Jewish people uncovering this which is hidden within, so too Hashem uncovered the previously hidden floor of the sea, and they walked through the floor of the sea as if it was dry land. That just as they themselves brought these hidden powers within them into the open, so too this which was hidden under the sea became revealed. And so too in every generation, through exposing these innermost powers of the soul, we are responded with a splitting of the sea and a redemption from Egypt. And as the prophet says, that as in the days when we came out of Egypt, so too in the Messianic age, we will be shown miracles from Hashem b'mheir of Yemenu Mamish. After the Jews had passed through the sea, they had a number of difficult times. Towards the end of the parsha, there was a tremendous thirst, a lack of water among the Jewish people. And they cried out against Moshe, saying, how could you lead us into the desert here so that we should die of thirst? And the people complained to Moses and said, Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im oyin. Is Hashem among us or is he not? As a result of this complaint, God answered them and had Moses take out water from the rock. However, God had another response. He said, you are asking whether I am present or not. I will show you. I will send the nation of Amalek to attack you. And then you will see whether I am present or not to save you from the nation of Amalek. As we see immediately thereafter in the Chumash, that Amalek was sent to attack the Jewish people. In reality, the story does need some explanation. After all, how is it possible that the Jewish nation could have such a doubt? This was the generation that had witnessed the plagues in Egypt and the splitting of the sea, and they're asking if Hashem is present. And so, too, the actual expression used in the verse is questionable. They said, Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im oyin. Is Hashem with amongst us, or is he not? It would have been sufficient in the Chumash to say, Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu. Is Hashem in our midst? And this would have been sufficient. And as we know, every single word of the Torah is precise, to the extent that entire laws are sometimes learned from an extra letter in the Chumash. Why should we have an expression, is Hashem in our midst, or is he not? The is he not is certainly self-understood. However, the Zohar explains that the doubt of the Jewish people was not regarding Hashem's presence in general. They were in doubt as to what revelation of godliness was accompanying them in the desert. And these two types of revelation are referred by the names Yesh and Ayin. As we have in the expression referring to the creation of the world, it was created yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. What are we referring to as the nothing? Nothing, we refer to the type of godliness which is higher than the world. And we refer to it as nothing because it is no existence that we can have a direct connection with. We cannot understand or connect ourselves with this revelation. It is so far above the world, we refer to it as ayin, it is nothing. God created a concrete, palpable world, and this is referred to as a yesh, a concrete existence. And it is this existence which is enlivened and kept in existence by godly revelation, but a lower type of revelation, as Hashem reveals himself in natural ways. Yesh, therefore, refers to the type of godliness which comes down to the world in the clothing of nature, whereas the idea of ayin, nothingness, refers to the type of godly revelation which is beyond any worldly limitations. And this is the realm from which the revelation of miracles comes about, that since a miracle breaks the natural boundaries of the world, this is a revelation of ayin, a level of godliness that the world normally cannot relate to. And these are the two types of godliness which the Jewish people were in doubt as to which was accompanying them in the desert. And the verse says, they asked, Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im ayin. Is Yesh among us, or is Ayin among us? In other words, they were not asking whether Hashem is here or not. They were asking which type of godly revelation was here. Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu? Is it the type of godly revelation which is down here in a Yesh, in a concrete existence, in a natural revealed state in the world? Im Ayin? Is it the type of godliness we refer to as Ayin, as nothingness, being higher than the world, in a miraculous sort of revelation? Now we can understand why the Jewish people should have had such a question. But now, the question is reversed. This being the case, that they had absolutely strong, unshakable belief in Hashem's presence, and the only doubt was to whether Hashem was going to deal with them in a way of nature, or a way of miracle, then the question becomes on the opposite side. Why should Hashem be so upset with this doubt? After all, they weren't expressing any doubt in Hashem's accompanying them. The only doubt is what sort of godliness was accompanying them, and what would be revealed. However, this itself was considered to be a transgression for them. After all, they had experienced such miracles that they had been in the Exodus from Egypt, as we mentioned before, the splitting of the sea. On a daily basis, they were still being given manna from heaven. Why should they imagine that the manna would suddenly stop? They were being given miracles on a daily basis. Why should they doubt that they would not be given miracles further? The truth is, even should they not have experienced any miracles, they should have had such belief. As the previous Rebbe described the difference between emunah and bitochen, emunah is faith. Faith that even though things appear to be bad, we have faith that Hashem does everything for the good, and therefore there is nothing really bad, Hashem is kind, and He only does what is necessary. However, there is something higher than emunah, that is bitachon. And bitachon is not only that bad things will happen and they're really for the good. A Jew's bitachon is that everything will actually turn out really to be good. And even should there be no way visible in the realm of nature that things should turn out good, nevertheless he has bitachon that it will turn out to be good. As he brings an example, that if a person is in a boat, and the boat sinks in the sea, and he sees a piece of straw to hang on to, then he goes to the straw with the hope he will be saved, that is not yet bitachon, that is still emunah. or that is tikva. He has a hope, because here is a natural way he can be saved. What is bitachon? When you don't even have the straw to grab onto. That's bitachon, that nevertheless, there is no natural way that you can see that you will be saved. But nevertheless, you believe Hashem will rescue you. That's true. Should there be no way whatsoever you can see of being saved? How much more so when they were experiencing miracles on a daily basis? And many of us also can think into our lives how we experience miracles and how Hashem takes care of us. And certainly there is no room we should worry that the kindnesses Hashem has done with us should stop. There is nothing to worry about. There is no cause for depression. The opposite is true. Even should we not have things, we should be penetrated with the total bitachon that Hashem will make everything really come out for the good in a way that we ourselves can experience.